Gators Breakdown, because there's never a dull moment in Gator Nation.
The Gators Breakdown Podcast is ready to go. I'm your host, David Waters, and you can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Joining me tonight on this episode of Gators Breakdown here live on YouTube is co-host Will Miles. You can find him on his site, readingreaction.com, and on Twitter at WillMilesSEC. Will, we were joking behind the scenes a bit before we come on here, and we had this Q&A episode planned for about a week or so, and then a pretty noteworthy article today comes out from Matt Hayes, Saturday Down South, that definitely caught your attention.
Yeah, I mean, something happened in Gator Nation. I can't believe it. And, you know, I mean, Hayes, I think Hayes said some things in the article that sort of people have suspected. The question is, I think it's pretty clear there's some tension between the university officials and the administration at Mullen. The question is how significant is that tension? And then, you know, he sort of made it sound like 2021 is like a make or break year for Mullen. And I think that's a really interesting question, because I've sort of gone into 2021 thinking this is a rebuilding year towards 2022. If this is a make or break year, then that sort of changes the calculus and changes whether we're going to see a lot of young guys on the field in 2021, right? So I do think that depending upon what the situation is behind the scenes may impact what we see on the field. But, you know, beyond that, we've got transfers to talk about and then all the questions everybody sent in. Certainly appreciate everybody's participation. So, you know, lots to talk about. And like you always say, man, never a dull moment.
Never. Of course. I don't think the situation is that dire as far as that article goes. I don't think it's, I think he did say it on its surface. Could it be a make or break type of year for Dan Mullen? And I don't see it being that far. And like you said, winning cures all. Winning carries everything else that follows. And the late season fall last year, along with some of the offseason antics, of course. You know, we've discussed a little bit of this stuff already. But combine all that stuff, and you know, you kind of see where the admin side of it may be a little frustrated. But if you keep winning, all that stuff gets glossed over. And you know, going back to Dan Mullen being a head coach at Mississippi State, and when he was hired here at Florida, you know, I think when he was hired, when we were discussing what's he going to be at Florida, we put a ceiling and a floor. And look, the floor for Dan Mullen, it's pretty good. I think there's still some question where the ceiling is with him, and we question that because of recruiting. And you know, 2020 was supposed to be the year, and it didn't really live up to the expectation in a lot of people's eyes. But you look at the floor and the type of coach we think Dan Mullen is, he's probably going to win enough to where, you know, there's not too big of a question. Especially as a lot of the fan base likes to remind us, when you compare it to Will Muschamp, when you compare it to Jim McElwain and what Dan Mullen has been able to bring to the table, he's winning enough to even, you know, to silence that criticism, I guess. It had to be a couple more years of being on the floor before I think you even attempt to move on for Dan Mullen for purely football reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the point of Hayes' article, right? Is that the reason to move on has nothing to do with football, other than maybe recruiting. It has to do with the administration not appreciating having their job being made more difficult by some of the things that Mullen has done. And I know, you know, it's funny, there's really kind of a divide when you look at the people who at least have reached out to me specifically, either through the website or on Twitter or on Facebook. Actually, there's a Twitter-Facebook divide as well. There are a lot of people who found the Darth Mullen stuff after Halloween, sort of inciting the brawl there, or at least participating in the brawl, and certainly not helping subjugate it. There's a divide. There are some people who loved it, right? They love the passion. They think it's hilarious that he came dressed up in his Halloween costume. You know, they think it's good that he doesn't take himself too seriously, at least in that particular aspect. And so the fan base is divided. Same thing with the Pack the Swamp comments after Texas A&M. You know, there's a fan base that's divided. The only thing we're not divided on, I think, is that LSU loss was absolutely horrible, and that the Oklahoma loss was pretty embarrassing, right? And I think that's where things start. You know, you're sort of sitting there 60-40, you're making excuses for it, and then you end on those three straight losses, only look good against Alabama, and the other two obviously not ideal. So You know, that's the reality is if the last three games become a more common occurrence, or if, you know, he's dressed up like a Wookiee next year after Halloween, after the game in Halloween, then, you know, people might get upset and it might cause some issues. But yeah, I think Dan Mullen's going to be around for a long time for a lot of reasons. One is I think that there isn't a college job that's better than Florida. Two is that I don't think the NFL necessarily wants somebody who has had some of the PR issues that he's had over the last couple of years. I think three, who is Florida going to get that's better? You know, we still have that awful episode in the past where we were extolling the virtues of Chip Kelly. And boy, I mean, what would we be saying if Chip Kelly was the head coach at Florida right now? Because there you wouldn't be winning any games and the recruiting would be terrible.
I'm not sure he'd be the head coach right now. We'd probably be talking about we're probably talking about Mullen being the head coach coming into this year if they had Chip Kelly then.
And Taggart might still be at FSU because they got a better record. But yeah, so I mean I get all that, right? I get all that. At the same time, you know, I think most of us suspected that there was tension between the administration and Mullen. Hayes's article makes it seem like the tension is more significant than maybe that I had thought, at least. And
this is not his first time. You know, about a month or a month and a half ago, he had another article that basically laid out everything that, you know, that where the tension from the admin and the and Mullen come from.
Yeah, but again, you know, you're dealing with a pandemic, you're dealing with fundraising and all the things that entails. And when you've got your fan base, or at least a significant portion of your fan base, ticked off at the way the head coach is acting in certain instances, both really off the field more than on the field, it makes your job more difficult, right? So we've all had difficult employees or direct reports or bosses, and you know, you sort of have to, you feel like you're walking on eggshells from time to time as you're trying to sort of fix a relationship where, you know, originally it was great and then somebody did something that wasn't perfect and you got to go fix that. And that's probably where Florida is at this point. You know, I think Hayes does represent the older Gator fan more than he does the younger Gator fan, and that's where I do think that the divide in terms of the off-field stuff especially does have an age disparity, right? I think the younger kids like some of the attitude, like some of the spouting off, and some of the more experienced Gator fans maybe are a little bit less tolerant of that stuff. But you know, the reality is as long as the money's coming in from the boosters, nobody's gonna care. And hey, it could be worse. We could have like a Freedom of Information Act releasing a bunch of emails that are talking about, you know, like Texas does with the Eyes of Texas and all that stuff going on over there. So, you know, the offseason, there's nothing to talk about. So when something like this comes out, that's one of the things you got to deal with.
Yep. And pretty much the base of the article, and I agree with it. And that, you know, we even without this article, you can still say it, keep winning. Doesn't matter. So it's really all it boils down to. Will quickly, I had a whole episode about it when the news broke on Sunday. Eric Gilbert decommitting from Florida, from the transfer portal, transfer from LSU, of course. You wrote a really, really nice article detailing your thoughts on it. We'll get into the wide receiver portion of your article and some of the stats and analytics you pull from there as we get to some of the questions here in the episode. But on the surface thought of Eric Gilbert and no longer being committed to the Gators.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is that you hope everything is okay with Gilbert, right? I mean, he left LSU in the middle of the season last year, decides to transfer to Florida. A month later, decides he's going to transfer someplace else. You know, there have been rumors about grades, and certainly, you know, you had sort of mentioned that you weren't necessarily going to get into the personal stuff on Twitter, and some people gave you a hard time for it. But I think the reality is it does sound like from some of the things that various people have said that there's more than just football when it comes to where Gilbert's going to end up playing. And so you wish him well. As far as the program is concerned, I mean, you know, one of the things that we've sort of been pushing back on is that you want good, high quality high school recruiting, because the transfer portal has risks and rewards. It's a high variance strategy, and bringing in a guy like Gilbert has an opportunity to bring you closer in talent level to the rivals that you're struggling to recruit against at the high school level. But losing him has the opposite effect, right? Is that you sort of held that spot for him, anticipating he was going to come. Maybe you would have done some things differently if you knew he wasn't going to be there. And more than anything, the advantage of the transfer portal, at least for Mullen thus far, has been his ability to hit, right? That Trevon Grimes and Van Jefferson and Adam Schuler and John Grenard have all been big-time contributors to the program. And if you're getting 100% hit on the transfer portal, then it really kind of makes it worth it, because you're probably only going to get 30, 40, 50% max hits at the high school level when you bring in those recruits. And so if you're getting 100% on a guy you bring in and only get 2 years from him, that's probably as good as a four-year high school commit, right? Like, that's probably on average what you're going to get out of a couple of high school commits. But when you start hitting at a much lower level, well, now it starts to really impact things. And I think the jury's still out on a lot of the five-star guys that Mullins brought in. You know, I mean, Brenton Cox played last year but wasn't like a real difference maker. Justin Shorter played last year but didn't look like a real difference maker. Lorenzo Lingard's coming off of a big knee injury at Miami, played like three or four plays last year. I think we expected him to get more run than he did. And then you've got DeMarcus Bowman coming in, who obviously is a very, very skilled player. At the same time, you know, he hasn't shown it at the college level yet. We hope he gets the opportunity to, but a wheel route during Instagram time during spring practice isn't going to convince me that he's a difference maker until he's actually out there on the field. So, you know, Gilbert was one of those guys who could help differentiate the program. He was one of those guys who was going to require the defense to pay attention to where he was and was going to make the defense make some uncomfortable choices, because LSU did this a lot where they'd split him out wide, very similarly to the way that Florida did with Kyle Pitts. It's not saying he was going to be Kyle Pitts or is going to be Kyle Pitts, but having a guy at the tight end position where you have to pay attention to him and you can't just sort of say, all right, we'll bring in our linebacker because we don't have to worry about guarding that guy. You know, that's a big deal. So it hurts the offense short term. I think it hurts the offense even more long term, because in 2022, when you had Emory Jones or Anthony Richardson or whoever ends up being the starting quarterback with a full year under his belt, having a guy like Eric Gilbert with a full year of the offense under his belt as well was going to mean he was going to be a real weapon, very similarly to the jump that we saw Pitts take from 2019 to 2020.
Yep. So, yep. Last episode, you can go get more of my thoughts there. There's Will's thoughts, and go to Will's site, readingreaction.com, to check more of his thoughts there on the Eric Gilbert situation. And we'll see where he ends up. We'll see, and hopefully all ends up well there. All right, before we get into our questions, everybody, thanks for sending them in. Remember, you can find Gators Breakdown at news4jax.com/GatorsBreakdown. There you'll find all the Gators Breakdown episodes, as well as News 4 Jax coverage of the Gators. You can head there and sign up for the new Gators Breakdown newsletter called Chomp. News4jax.com, find it there under the newsletters tab. Help us out here on Gators Breakdown. Please share, rate, and review the show on YouTube. A lot of you watching right now, hit that like button, hit that subscribe button. It really helps us out with the YouTube algorithm out there. And find us on social media. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Gators Breakdown. Will, let's get into the first question here from at B Saloni. He goes, do you think we'll use Anthony Richardson in specialty packages similar to how Emory was used last year? Unlike with Trask and Emory, AR and Emory has seemed to have more similar skill sets. So we can go to this one pretty easily, because you and I were both discussing Mullins' press conference yesterday, and this comes on the heels of Mullins said he'll play multiple quarterbacks early in the season, and that meant to some what sounded like a quarterback competition. And I fully expect Richardson to push Emory Jones, but you know, Emory's going to get every chance in the spring, fall camp, early season to prove he's the guy first, unless Richardson just completely blows the doors off the competition. Mullen likes to go with the experienced player here at the quarterback position, but also have guys ready to go. He's played multiple guys since he's been the coach here. So I don't know why this caught so many off guard with him mentioning this and playing multiple quarterbacks. Now, these two do have more of a similar skill set than Felipe Franks and Emory Jones, or a Kyle Trask and Emory Jones. But like Mullen said, it's making sure you get guys ready and have look, this season specifically, you didn't have it last season, but Anthony Richardson did play a little bit anyway. You have those easier games early in the season. So, of course, you're going to play multiple quarterbacks earlier on in the season. That should be the expectation. But going kind of more to the question here, you know, I can still see a package for Anthony Richardson. We discussed this when we did our offensive preview, a little while ago, that, you know, still see a package for Anthony Richardson while Emory's starting. And I do wonder, will he be limited to mostly running like Emory, or will Mullen let him throw it a bit more? I still think with his frame, you let him take some of those short yardage carries and move a pile if need be to save Emory from taking so many hits. But I just think the biggest question is, does it get to a point where Richardson forces Mullen's hand in getting more snaps or taking the job because of the play of Emory and or Richardson just, you know, improving so much that he forces a takeover? So, you know, extending on what Mullen said in his latest press conference, you know, spring's being used to throw a lot at these guys to see what they can handle and then dial it back to see what they do well, to keep doing what they do well. So, you know, whichever player proves they can handle more than the other will ultimately be the quarterback. And the early expectation is Emory's got a leg up. You know, he's been groomed for the position for the last few seasons. He's got the experience rolling into the season. It's going to take a lot. You know, if a lot of people want to take Mullen's comments to mean a starting quarterback, it's going to take a lot for Emory Jones not to be the starter. So, yeah, I think the expectation should be some packages for Anthony Richardson, using probably similar to how we've seen Emory Jones, unless he just goes out there and proves and forces Mullen's hands that he can go and throw the ball more.
Yeah, I mean, I'll believe that Anthony Richardson's going to get a lot of play when I actually see it. I thought Emory Jones was going to get a lot of play when Felipe Franks went down, and it turned out that Kyle Trask was the backup quarterback and was an awfully good player. So, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you wonder whether what they were missing in practice that Trask wasn't in there in the first place, but then also what they saw in Trask that made them put him in front of Emory instead of having Emory come in at the backup position when Franks went down. You know, you look at guys like Dak Prescott, who obviously are very skilled guys, able to go to the NFL, similar build when it comes to, you know, comparison to Anthony Richardson. And Prescott still got very limited play his freshman year. And then in his sophomore year, you know, Tyler Russell still threw 109 balls on, you know, in his sophomore year, even when Dak took over. So even if you were grooming Anthony Richardson to take over, Emory Jones is still going to get plenty of run. And then the other thing is, you mentioned it already, you know, the fact that Emory Jones is 210 pounds, Anthony Richardson's 235, and a couple inches taller, those goal line runs that, you know, the one I'm thinking about specifically is against Oklahoma. I think Emory Jones basically buried his head and really went after a touchdown, got it against Oklahoma. But you don't want him taking those hits over a 12 or 13 game season. Like, that's just not something that you want your starting quarterback to be doing. And so I think Richardson's going to get those types of opportunities. And then the cupcakes will free him up to throw a little bit more. But I'm really not expecting to see two quarterback systems. I think Mullen, you know, I do wonder whether Urban Meyer sort of twisted his arm a little bit to get him to do the Chris Leak, Tim Tebow exchange. Like, I wonder whether that was specific to Meyer wanting to get his five-star guy that he had recruited into the game, somebody that everybody was excited about. They sort of saw, hey, this worked and kept going with it. But was that dictated by Urban Meyer and Dan Mullen is really sort of constitutionally against it, because it feels like that's not something that he has done since. Now, he hasn't had somebody as gifted as Richardson since Tebow and Leak were in there. So maybe that changes a little bit, but you know, the fact that he was.
And never really had a quarterback coming into the program as talented as Tebow to really even try it. You know, sure. Now Prescott ended up being that, but not coming in that way.
Sure. But I mean, again, I go back to last year. I really expected Emory Jones to get a lot of running. Mm-hmm. Because and that they would allow him to throw every once in a while. Now, obviously, they let him throw, I think, on the second drive of the year against Ole Miss, and then he threw a pick on a deep throw, and then they didn't let him throw for like four straight games after that. And so, you know, maybe he was earning that, right? I mean, maybe he wasn't performing in practice, and so they weren't giving him the opportunity. But it really did surprise me during the year how little they let him throw, because you knew what was coming this year, right? I mean, you pretty much knew Kyle Trask was going to be gone and that you were going to have to – you would wanted to get experience. So when you're up by 30 points against Vanderbilt, you know, chuck the ball around a little bit, right? When you fall behind against, you know, against Alabama or something, chuck the ball around. Like, whenever you had an opportunity to get him in there, I'm surprised that they didn't throw the ball as much. Even the game against Oklahoma, they really didn't throw the ball all that much in the second half. Now, he wasn't real successful in the second half. I think he was like 3-9 or 3-10 or something like that in the second half against Oklahoma. But, you know, that just has not been Mullen's MO. So I'm not expecting it from Richardson. I think Richardson's going to get, you know, 32 to 40 throws next year, and Jones is going to get the, you know, 250 because they're not going to throw it 500 times like they did last year. But Jones will get 250. Richardson will get, you know, 50, 60, 70 throws maybe. And that'll be it, right? He's going to get his feet wet a little bit, but nothing major and nothing that actually impacts the nature of the season unless it's a running play in the red zone.
Yeah, I mean, there's a contingent out there that thinks he can give Emory a push out there, but it's not going to come this spring. I don't think it's going to be something we'll see in the fall.
There was a contingent last year that thought Jones was going to be that trash. So, you know, yep. I mean, the reality backup is that
always a contingent of a backup quarterback.
Always the most popular guy in the room.
All right. Zach Permenter said this. He goes, do you think the offensive line outside of Josh Braun will be capable of generating enough push to open up running lanes to complement the stable of backs Florida has this year? Seems like Hevesy has not been able to field a squad that can get much done in that department yet. So we really hit this hard, some of this hard last week, and you can catch most of it there when we were discussing when we saw the starting offensive line now at the first practice. But, you know, going with this part and the tail end of the question here is that you feel that basically Hevesy being able to field a squad that can get that hasn't been able to get much done yet. Look, it starts at recruiting and guys not getting on campus. You know, the best recruit at the position was Isaiah Walker. Never played a down for Florida. You have 3-4 stars from the 2019 class that never played a down from Florida on the offensive line. William Merard, Deave Hammond, Wardrick Wilson will never play a game for Florida. At one point, you had all these guys that should be competing for spots all along the offensive line, and for one reason or another, never played a down, never will play a down for the Gators. So when it's said by fans that Hevesy hasn't been able to field a squad that can get much done in that department yet, look no further than that right there and recruiting and guys not getting – I mean, the recruiting part, I guess, was good, but you just didn't get them on campus. You got them committed. You got them signed. They used counters. That's where it hurts you too, but they never were able to get on the field. So now that doesn't really do anything for spring, of course. That's where you got to look and what they're going to focus on this spring. But, you know, that's why I think if you're looking at the offensive line and for improvement, you know, it's just you're not having a big talent infusion to try and get some production there. So we hit on it last week, as I said, but briefly again, the focus, you know, back to a run focused offense should benefit the offense. I think it suits what John Hevesy's been used to in his coaching career and developing players in his career for that style of offense. And we'll go back to 2018. And by the end of the season, with a running game split between Jordan Scarlett and LaMichael Perine, with a bit of Felipe Frank sprinkled in, the run offense was a force toward the end of in Dan Mullen's first season, especially toward the end of that year. You know, with all the change from McElwain to Mullen, by the time 2018 ended, that was a team strength, the offensive line and the run game. So there is hope there. So now, you know, this spring so far, kind of going around and asking, you know, not surprised the defensive line's kind of ahead of the offensive line. Offensive line's replacing Brett Heggie at center. Stone Forsyth at tackle, who was playing really well last season. So as this change in focus happens this spring for the offensive line, you know, don't need to catch up with inserting the new pieces at the same time. So to answer the question, I really do think the offensive line will complement the run game, as it's what Hevesy is known for. And I think, you know, having a quarterback that can run will help. But we'll also symbiotic here, I think, with the running backs. The running backs will help this offensive line. But it may take some time. It may take like a 2018 to where it's going to be in the second half of the season before you see it really all click.
Yeah, I mean, I hope not.
I hope not.
I think we're in for a long season if the offensive line isn't really kicking in. I think part of it is that, you know, there was a lot of discussion in sort of Gator media this week about missing spring practice and last year and how much that impacted the team. And I think there are times where you look at it and say, okay, that's an excuse that everybody had to deal with that, and that, you know, not lining up correctly for senior players shouldn't be a problem when you miss spring practice. But I think at the offensive line position, particularly with Stuart Reese coming in, some of the continuity there, moving guys around a little bit to make sure that they, you know, that they were able to accommodate Reese, did impact continuity on the offensive line. That's something that's really important. Also strength, right? You talk about the 2019 class, the 2020 guys that they brought on the offensive line. you know, all of those guys didn't necessarily have strength and conditioning. And we saw that in the fourth quarter. So if you think about the fourth quarter for Florida last year, they didn't really win many fourth quarters at all. They certainly lost the fourth quarter against LSU. They definitely lost against Oklahoma. They lost against Texas A&M. And even against teams like Tennessee and Kentucky, you know, the fourth quarter when we thought they should be putting those teams away, they just weren't doing it. And in some cases, that was because they couldn't run the ball. I think in some cases, it was because they were trying and really couldn't run the ball. And then I think some of it was is that the offense was just geared to do what Kyle Trask does best, right? And that's chuck the ball all over the place. If you're averaging 12 yards a play, you know, why bother running the ball? And so I think a lot of times they got away from it. And by the time they got to the fourth quarter, the defense wasn't exhausted. And so you just kept throwing the ball because that was the best way to move the ball and run the clock. So I think this year they're going to have more emphasis on it, right? I don't think it's going to be 45% run and 55% passing. I think the fact that, you know, it's a big deal that you have an extra blocker if Emory Jones is running. That makes a huge difference. So one guy misses a block, it doesn't matter. Jones still just has to make one guy miss. If everybody hits their block, Jones doesn't have to make anybody miss, and he's off to the races. And then having the dual threat where the safeties aren't necessarily going to be able to cheat up like they did when Emory got the ball last year, but now they'll actually have to respect the pass a little bit. Or you get one-on-one and it opens up stuff on the outside. I think that's going to help the offensive line too, right? That when Emory Jones was in last year, the defensive line was able to – or the defense in particular, the defensive – the safeties and linebackers were able to cheat. They won't be able to do that this year. And then when you know, the sort of slow-developing RPOs, things like that, you know, the running backs were not equipped to take the ball to the house. That's the reality, is that LaMichael Perine left. Damian Pierce was okay, but wasn't great. And they didn't have somebody who was able to take the ball to the house. And that's the other thing, is that I think DeMarcus Bowman, if he's who we think he is going to make the offensive line look a lot better than they did last year, just by virtue of being DeMarcus Bowman. And you put him and Emory Jones in the backfield, that's where the offensive line improves, is mm-hmm. You get a guy who can make somebody miss, who can turn a 10-yard gain into an 80-yard gain, and all of a sudden the statistics look way better because the offensive line doesn't even need to do its job that much more often. They just need to have a guy who's able to make the defense pay when they get out of position, in the same way that Trask was able to make a defense pay last year when they got out of position through the air.
Well, I'll go back to a minute. Do you think I'm making too much out of it, the whole Hevesy thing? I mean, go back to his time at Mississippi State and the offense they ran most of the time there. It'd been a run-focused, run-first approach. And I'm not sure he was so suited for developing an offensive line that needed to drop back and pass protect 40, 45 times a game. Maybe this is what he needs. And, you know, if you know, Florida's recruited quarterbacks that you would think they could go back and go to that style where they're dropping back 40 times a game, and maybe Florida needs to assess what they do at offensive line coach when they make that move to that style of quarterback again. But, you know, could that hold some weight that this style of offense helps an offensive line coach like him?
Maybe a little bit. I think it does go back to – it points out recruiting, right? I mean, we harp on it all the time, and it's important. That's why we harp on it all the time. And, you know, I think people understand the concept of a three-down linebacker, right? That a guy who can go out there that you don't have to take off the field, whether it's a running play or a pass play. So you think about a guy like Ray Lewis, right, out there playing linebacker. You never had to take him off the field because he was skilled enough to do everything he needed to do as a middle linebacker. Well, – who does Florida have on the offensive line that you'd say is a true three-down offensive lineman, right? Like I pointed out, I think, last week that I think DeLance was actually decent, maybe even better than decent when it came to the running game. I think he probably graded out pretty well when it came to the running game. The problem is they didn't emphasize the running game last year, so that skill was not necessarily the best skill for your right tackle to have. So this year
– Stuart Reese, who they brought in, you know, what did he? What kind of offense did he play in under Mullen and Hevesy? He was there when Nick Fisher was a quarterback. So, of course, it was a run-focused offense.
Well, and this is one of the reasons why oftentimes you'll recruit a tackle and then you'll move him inside to guard, because the guy's limited in terms of his ability to be a tackle. Like, he just doesn't have the physical capability of doing all the things you're going to ask a tackle to do. You move him into guard, and all of a sudden he's a really, really good guard. Well, again, if you're bringing in guys who are low-level three-star, high-level three-star, those guys can still be very, very good. But usually – they're going to have some physical limitations, right? So when Alabama recruited Alex Leatherwood and Florida was recruiting Alex Leatherwood, everyone knew Leatherwood was going to be a first-round NFL draft pick when he came in, right? Same thing with who's the guy? Petit Frere up at Ohio State, right? Everybody knew he was going to be a multiple year starter at Ohio State at tackle. And you start looking at the teams that are making the playoffs, and all of those teams have guys on the offensive line who have been there for two or three years, who've built continuity, who are highly skilled. And really, I think.
Well, you're talking about Special Leather, how Special Leatherwood is. When Alabama beat Georgia for the national championship game, he was playing left tackle in the national championship game as a true freshman. That's how special he was.
It turns out he's pretty good. So, yeah. it's funny. People complain about the recruiting rankings and how they're biased and that sort of stuff. I think, you know, I wrote an article maybe a month ago talking about how I would recruit if I was struggling. And the premise was spend all your money on getting the five stars and then bring in three stars, because the three stars and the four stars, the differentiation is relatively small, but those can't miss prospects are the ones that really make a difference long-term for your program. Offensive line's a little bit less important because I think you can paper over some holes there, but you know, that's what I would say is the concept of a three down linebacker that applies to offensive line. It's just, you don't necessarily think of it that way, but you're going to have offensive linemen who can pass protect better. You're going to have offensive linemen who can run block better. If you find one who can do both, and can do them both really, really effectively, well, then you're talking about a guy who's probably a high-level four-star or a five-star guy, because those are things that you'll be able to pick up from a scouting perspective. You'll be able to see a guy who's got quick feet and is able to do, you know, who just has the ability and the strength and all those different things that you can pick up at camps. Like, you know, the 7-on-7, I think oftentimes maybe glosses over some things, but I think from an offensive line perspective, when you see a guy manhandle all the people he's going up against, it tells you something about him. It's the guys who are sort of the tweeners that you have trouble figuring out, okay, what's this guy going to project to the next level? And Florida has a lot of those guys.
Yep. Perfect transition here. Kavern Harris, a good friend in the program, says we all know offensive line has to you know, be better. Of course, he goes, but give me the next position group who has to take the biggest step. And he mentions linebacker. And then Zach Permenter says, outside of Miller and Diabate, who do you think would be getting major snaps among the younger backers? So since Kavern Harris mentioned linebackers and there was a question about them from Zach as well, you know, we'll concentrate on that. Going back to Kavern, though, next position group that has to take the biggest step, I think you can say linebacker as well, but I'll probably put the secondary up there as well when you look at it from my perspective. We can get into that at a different time. We've discussed it in some of the previous episodes here, but something that I think helps here when we take a look at this linebacker group, and Ventrell Miller, he's missing some time this spring, minor injury there. But look, that helps a bit with getting some younger guys some reps that who probably need the reps, who did not get the reps last year. So the obvious answers here are, you know, the two names that we heard so much last season, Tyron Hopper, Derek Wingo. Those are the guys. Those are the guys that need to be fighting for snaps at the linebacker position. And this is their first spring. Huge for those guys. Both needed some development, whether it be putting on some weight or just getting on the field for experience. With no spring, a different kind of fall camp last year for these young guys, it was going to be tough to see the field. Now this spring, especially with Miller missing some time, these younger players get experience. Staff gets to see what they do well. And for Hopper, you know, playing very athletic, very fast to the ball, making big hits, but need to play consistently and within the scheme of the defense. For Wingo, you know, it's a bit of a transition. He rushed off the edge in high school. We need to fit into that inside linebacker role if he's gonna play linebacker for Florida. So there's an adjustment period that's going to take place there with Wingo. Maybe why you didn't see him on the field a whole lot last year. He rushed off the edge in high school. New position for him to play linebacker. So you think he was going to get off to a fast start last season? That probably wasn't going to happen. He wasn't going to get that last season with no spring and a different kind of fall camp. So, you know, and, you know, to play that role of linebacker, he needed to add some weight as well. So, you know, both of these guys needed to mature a bit from last season to hit the ground running this spring. And look, and especially James Houston transferring out, another opportunity with Miller being out this spring hampered by an injury. James Houston transferred out not long ago. It benefits Florida to have you know, these guys develop into playmakers this season, and more importantly, this spring now. The opportunity is there for them to get the reps and develop this spring. And I think that can allow this staff to move Mamudi Abate around if they want and rush off the edge a bit more. But like we discussed last week, you know, Diabate, also Bernie, did get better at linebacker towards the end of 2020 and now have a spring after that foundation. But adding guys like Hopper and Wingo gives this position a lot more flexibility, probably a lot more athleticism overall, Will. And one player, probably one more worth mentioning as well, is David Reese, returning from an injury last season after also being injured the year before. He's been discussed as having the tools, but just can't really get on the field because of all the injuries. Has to start coming together for him this spring as well.
Yeah, I think when I think about linebacker for the 2021 season, I think about Diabate. Like, he's the guy who, you talk about three down linebackers. Diabate is the guy who has the skill to be a three down linebacker. Ventrell Miller, I actually love a lot of things about him, but side to side, covering running backs out of the backfield. I mean, Alabama really took advantage of Florida's linebackers in whole, Diabate included, with Najee Harris in that SEC championship game. And Diabate, I think, more because of positioning and instincts than it was necessarily because of physical limitations. And Diabate really has some unbelievable closing speed when it comes to getting to the quarterback once he realizes that he has the opportunity to rush when the running back doesn't go out of the backfield or something like that. You know, you mentioned Bernie. I think Bernie has an opportunity potentially to take a step up, but we've been waiting for that now for 2 or 3 years. And we've seen a guy who struggles at times. We've seen a guy who really struggles in coverage. And we'll see whether he's able to pull that together. I do think that Miller may be missing some reps this spring helps Bernie in particular, because he's going to be one of those veterans that they sort of rely on to teach some of the younger guys. The other thing, and I was thinking about this the other day, Chris Bogle, actually, he's listed as a linebacker in some in sub publications. And really, with Jeremiah Moon coming back and with all the Bucks that they've recruited, like, I think Bogle really was effective off the edge last year. But one of the things but so was Diabate a couple of years ago. And I'm wondering whether they actually decide that Bogle has the speed, because he's got the same kind of closing speed. And I wonder whether maybe they'll think about playing Bogle in more of a traditional linebacker role. Because if all of a sudden you've got Moon on the outside, the two transfer defensive tackles, you got Zach Carter on the other side, Brenton Cox coming off the edge, and then you've got Bogle and Diabate out there at linebacker, you've got more talent on the field than you did last year. Maybe those guys aren't necessarily experienced, but so I haven't heard anything about Bogle coming off, you know, from having his hand in the dirt, but that's a guy I'd look at if I was Florida and say, he's got closing speed. He's got the ability to hang with guys in coverage, and why waste that by having him zone blitz every once in a while? Let's get him out there, teach him to be a linebacker in some circumstances, particularly against running, against running formations. Maybe get him a little bit more variation in terms of his ability to rush the quarterback. Put him rushing right behind Brenton Cox with a couple of stunts being run, and all of a sudden you can imagine the offensive line for the opposition having some real issues.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that pinged in my head, and I think it was the Peach Bowl, but CC Jefferson was lining up as a linebacker in some sets. Now, don't get me wrong, you're not going to ask him to play linebacker, but in Todd Grantham's defense, where he likes to rotate guys and come up with something exotic at times, CC Jefferson was up there in the middle of the field in one of the linebacker spots. So you could maybe see somebody like Bogle in some spots, like you're saying, you know, if this defense can get its legs under him and stop the communication issues and actually go out there and just develop things like this, you could see some players that you wouldn't necessarily normally see in that spot in a few plays a game there, just, you know, in certain situations.
Yeah, well, we also have like 21 blue chip Bucks under scholarship. So, you know, at some point we got to figure out what to do with the ball, get the best guys on the field. So, that would be something you could potentially explore in the spring, right? Is take a guy who's shown that explosion, who's shown the closing speed. That's the thing, is when you look at Diabate, his ability to go from 0 to 60 and get to the quarterback, big, long strides, get to the quarterback quick, even when it's a delayed blitz, even when he's waiting to see whether the running back's going to release, all those sorts of things. And then immediately being able to get in the quarterback's face. Against Terry Wilson in Kentucky in particular, he terrorized Kentucky from the linebacker position and getting in Wilson's face. If you can do the same thing with a guy like Bogle, or if you can get Bernie more comfortable, because he's got he doesn't seem to have the closing speed, but he has some good coverage skills. And so the question is, if you get him in the right position, do those coverage skills all of a sudden start to become instinct, and then you get that benefit as well? So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, Grantham has been a little bit mum on what went wrong last year. He really doesn't want to talk about last year. So we'll see. Hopefully he'll talk about this year a little bit and give us a little bit of insight into what's going on the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Chief Borders too, seems to be turning some heads out there, true freshman out there, early enrollee, maybe can insert himself in there. Like they kind of said, I think Florida needs some more true linebackers. And I think him recruited as a true linebacker could really help the Gators there in early spring, help himself as also not necessarily getting the rotation this year, but spring's a good time to set a launching pad for future seasons as well. So Crunch Time Sports Advantage sends this. I've been on his podcast a few times, and he was asking, he goes, with all the departing receiving production, who has to step up and become the primary option? Will, I think this one's easy. Of course, I think you have to start with Jacob Copeland. Here, seeing he's the most experienced wide receiver returning, can he take that Kadarius Toney style leap? I think that's the question we have to ask ourselves here. Has to fix some drop issues that we saw at times last year, but you've seen early in these early drills, you know, it's dangerous how much we can. I think we and Thomas Goldkamp, we had the conversation on Twitter about how much can you actually take away from all these videos that Florida's putting out on Instagram Live. You can't take a whole lot, but you know, I think you still have to mention what you see. And Jacob Copeland's out there. You see in these early drills, he's beating DBs on some of these routes that he's running with your burst, just plain beating defensive backs. And don't get me wrong, you know, he's not going to be able to do the things Kadarius Toney was able to do, and that's not a knock on him. There's not many people out there who can do the things Kadarius Toney was able to do. You know, but you know, it's more about, can you do the small things that add up for a big jump like Kadarius Toney did last year? Run the right route, make the catch, make defenders miss after the catch, or on a run if you're getting the ball off of a handoff. So, I mean, Will, in Toney's first three seasons, 15 catches in Jim McElwain's final season, then 25 catches, 10 catches in seven games in 2019 as he was dealing with injuries, and then a huge leap to 70 catches last year for Kadarius Toney. Now, Copeland isn't getting that many. Look, shifting offense is going to determine that and dictate that. But he's not. The shifting offense is going to hurt him there. But can he become that dependable, a dependable target like Kadarius Toney? Yeah, one catch his first season, redshirting there. But then in 21 catches in 2019, then 23 last season. That in offense that was spreading the ball around to a lot of playmakers. So now, you know, he's the guy that has to become that stable force in the wide receiver room, become the leader of the wide receiver group, because he's the most experienced guy. And look, he was Dan Mullen's first big-time wide receiver recruit going back to that 2018 class.
Yeah, I mean, I think Copeland has the skill. He had 8 explosive plays last year, only 23 catches. So averaged 18.9 yards per catch, which was, I think, highest on the team. So he has the explosion. The things that we're going to be looking for from a development standpoint are the consistency and the attitude, right? There were some times last year where there were some things put on Twitter and other things that I think, you know, you want to make sure that your juniors and senior leaders aren't necessarily doing, that they're leading the group. And even if they're not necessarily getting the ball their way, that they are, that they're cheering on their teammates. And, you know, it was funny when he had that, I think, what was it, Grimes, who took the ball away from him against Tennessee on the little slant sort of going back and forth, you know, and I think it was all in fun, but the thing is, you sort of walk on eggshells because it hasn't always been in fun. So that, those are sort of the things you look for from Copeland. The bigger thing is who's going to pick up the rest of the slack, right? I mean, so he had eight explosive last year, but you think about the four guys they're losing: Grimes, Toney, Copeland, and Pitts. They combined for 50 of the Gators' 75 explosive plays in 2020. But they also accounted for 24 of the 55 explosives in 2019. So people are going to say, oh, well, you know, we lost four wide receivers in 2019 and we didn't skip a beat. In fact, everybody got better. Well, that's true, except for that the guys who stepped up last year are all guys who had a track record of having explosive plays. Really,
Yeah, well, you didn't hear that from us. We felt pretty confident about that receiver group last year, and both of us, you know, we don't see that production returning again for 2021.
No, I wrote an article last year looking at those explosives saying, hey, I think they're going to be okay. I don't know whether they'll be fantastic. Turned out they were fantastic, and a lot of that was due to Tony really stepping up. But, you know, the only guys who really stepped up other than Copeland to deliver explosive plays wasn't even really one guy. It was a combination of the running backs. You had Malik Davis with 6, and then you had Naquan Wright and Damian Pierce with another 5 between the two of them. So you got 11 explosive plays out of the running backs. The problem is that if DeMarcus Bowman's playing running back, then those guys who were your explosive playmakers are either sitting on the bench or you got to find a different place to put them. So we've talked a little bit about having 2 back sets. We've talked a lot about, I think people expect there's probably going to be some opportunities to split Malik Davis out wide. You know, you're going to have him in the screen game, those sorts of things. But there's only so many balls to go around to running backs. You can split 4 wide receivers out. You're not going to play a game with four running backs on the field. And so they need guys, you know, whether it's Whittemore, Henderson, Frazier, Shorter. You know, Shorter only had 2 explosive plays last year. Whittemore had 3. So Whittemore actually did show a little bit of explosion because he wasn't necessarily out there all the time. Zipper had 3. Gamble had 3. Henderson had 1.
And Mullen said DeMarcus Weston might be the fastest player on the team. So maybe we finally get to see, Weston enter the rotation here as well.
Yeah, I just said the same thing I said about the quarterback throwing the ball, right? I'll believe it when I see it, right? They are consistent in terms of putting guys out there who've already done it. Now, one of the things the pandemic did is that because there weren't any cupcakes last year, because they didn't have a spring practice, they're going to be forced to put some people out there this year who haven't already done it just because there isn't anybody who has, right? There isn't going to be anybody you're going to be able to put out there. But I think this is part of why they had the 2 units last year.
That's where I was going. Yeah.
Pull Pitts and all those guys off and have the second unit on there. So they've at least gotten a little bit of experience. So if I'm looking at where the plays are going to come from, it's from that second unit, right, that was out there last year. So guys like Shorter and Whittemore and Zipper are probably the guys you're sort of looking for to fill that void. I'm just not real confident that they're going to be able to do it for 2 reasons. One is that they don't have the same track record that Pitts and Tony and Grimes did. You know, say what you will about Tony in 2019, but he had a track record of when he touched the ball, he generated explosive plays and he made the offense move. And that goes all the way back to his first year with Jim McElwain as well. Like when Tony touched the ball, he was magic. It was that they never got him the ball very much. And then he got injured in 2019. I haven't seen that yet with these guys, right? The only real play I can remember for Zipper of any significance was the play where he sort of pushed off against the DB against Georgia and really gave him a big play after Georgia had gone up 14-0. That's a big deal, but that's the only time I really remember it. Whittemore, there were a couple of jump balls he went and got that Trask threw up to him that I don't necessarily think were great throws and was able to get those. Gamble hit a couple of, hit the big one from the end zone against Vanderbilt, hit the big one against Georgia.
Didn't Zipper have one in against Arkansas as well? I believe they had. There was that little stretch there after Pitts went down at the Georgia game where Zipper and Gamble did some nice things, but
I guess my point is that, like, I'm not sure I remember one explosive play from Kyle Pitts last year because there were explosive plays all over the place, right? It's hard to pinpoint one or two. We're sort of sitting here and saying, hey, these guys have the ability to do it. The question is the quarterback going to be able to deliver the ball? Is the offensive line going to give them the time? And then is the offense even going to be tailored towards having those explosive plays? So, we'll see. I think DeMarcus Bowman is really going to have to be what we think he is for this offense to be fantastic. I think if he is, if he is adjusting to the college game and isn't necessarily taking the ball to the house, every other game, and, if Emory Jones gets a little bit nicked and can't run the ball quite as well, then the offense is going to struggle a little bit. Because I don't think – they definitely don't have a guy that they could just say, run a back shoulder fade and we're going to chuck it up to you. Right. And last year when they got one-on-one on Pitts, it was a back shoulder fade every time. And, is that read going to be there? Do they have that player who they're confident that they can just throw it up every time? And, again, nobody's going to be Kyle Pitts, but they don't have that track record. So it concerns me, right? I mean, Georgia 2 years ago had to replace all their wide receivers, and Jake Fromm really struggled. And part of the reason he struggled is they didn't have any track record of anybody who could come in and play consistently. And the wide receivers weren't very consistent. And then Fromm wasn't really able to adjust. That'll be the question, right? I think we all believe Dan Mullen's a better offensive coach than anybody they've had their coach in offense at Georgia. And so his ability to adjust, his ability to put his players in the best position to succeed is what we're banking on. But, you know, at the same time, you got to have guys out there who can execute your offense and that you trust. And thus far at the receiver position, the only guy out there that I would say Mullen's going to have a whole lot of trust in is Copeland. And like you mentioned, there's been some inconsistency there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, going into 2018, we probably felt the same way in Dan Mullen's first year of receivers not living up to the billing of Freddie Swain, Tyree Cleveland, Josh Hammond, the four-star guys that we were wanting to see more out of. And I think we got a glimpse in 2018 of what those guys could do in 2019, and they lived up to the billing. So a lot of credit to Billy Gonzalez there, and hopefully he can work his magic one more time for the 2021 season. Trey Simpson sends this one in. Will, how good do you think this defensive line can be this year? Do you think this could be the best defensive line in Mullen's tenure at Florida? And extending that, J-Rod says, are the transfers at D-line going to make a big impact, or are they just fillers for depth? Look, I think this has the chance to become – I don't know if I can say – the best. I mean, it'll only be year four for Mullen, but you know, kind of comparing here to some of them there, I think up the middle, if they get some strong play up the middle, mentioning these transfers, I think there's a chance this one can become the best, but they got to get more production pass rushing as far as just figuring out one guy who you can just really count on to do it, you know. There's a chance, you know, you insert Shelton, you insert new Kurt, you know, can they make instant impacts like Mullen says he's looking for transfers to do? They were brought to be those type of players along with Gervin Dexter, not the filler types. You know, your filler pieces right now are Lamar Goods, Jalen Humphries, Jalen Lee, and we'll see how the development goes for true freshman Desmond Watson, Christopher Thomas. But no, you brought in Shelton and Newkirk to come in, play right away, be instant impact guys. They play Power 5 football. They play Big Ten. They play SEC football. Those guys are expected to come in and produce right away and be leaders right away, as Mullen said in the pre-spring press conference. But I find it tough to say this can be the best unit until I see a pass rusher at the level of a Jabari Zuniga, Jonathan Grenard, Ja'Kai Polite. Florida had a lot of sacks last season, led the SEC most of the season. Finished with 35 sacks. That was one less game played than Alabama, who led with 36 in the SEC. So the sack numbers were still there, but you couldn't pinpoint any player and compare what they did to the ones I previously mentioned. So until I see a defensive front get pushed and stop the run like they did 2018 and 2019, those fronts and those defensive lines, you know, of course, that consisted of combinations of players like Ja'Kai Polite, Jabari Zuniga, C.C. Jefferson, Adam Schuler, Campbell, Slayton, Grenard. I can't put this group up there just yet, but I like the potential with the transfers in the middle, Gervin Dexter, and then some names, you know, Carter Chatfield, Eamon Melan, Brenton Cox. Those are the guys you're going to count on up front that if you're going to put them up there as Dan Mullen's best defensive line, those are guys that are going to have to come up there and prove it.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle to say this is going to be their best defensive line for two reasons. One is I think, you know, you look at Ja'Kai Polite had 11 sacks back in 2018. Grenard, I think, had 10 in 2019. Last year, you know, the leader was 5 for Zach Carter, and then the next was 3.5 for Brenton Cox. So, yes, Florida led the SEC in sacks. But the other thing is the 3 years in Grantham's scheme, there's been a lot of empty calories. When it comes to the sacks, you know, you had 10 mm-hmm. against Miami in 2019. And then, you know, we thought it was going to be just, you know, terrorizing opposing offensive lines and then got absolutely shut down. Well, it was 49
sacks on the season and you had 18 versus Miami and FSU combined, I think.
So I guess that's my point, right, is that it's feast or famine with Grantham. And if you're going to call it his best defensive line, then we'll know against Alabama. Right. Yeah. That if they can get 3 or 4 sacks against Alabama, then you go, okay, this is a team that can get sacks against anybody. And that means that guys like Cox, guys like, you know, guys like Carter, guys like Bogle, guys like Diabate have added to the new guys at defensive tackle, that the guys at defensive tackle are probably freeing up the linebackers to allow them to come in and get some sacks. And that, you know, that the team is a little bit more, you know, better oiled to do that sort of thing. And it's not just empty calories, because that's the thing against LSU, you know, 2 years ago, against Georgia 2 years ago, against Georgia 3 years ago, it was just, they couldn't get to the quarterback at all. And you saw the same thing last year against Alabama, right? Had no, the defensive line, they got to him a couple of times, but really nothing that actually changed the game. And that's
the thing. It's been an issue in a lot of the big games, Will, that we go to your point, you know, Georgia, first few years, LSU in 2019, just the big games, the pass rush wasn't there.
Yeah, well, and that's the deal. If you want to be known as the best defensive line in Grantham's history at Florida, it doesn't matter what you do against East Tennessee Tech. Like, what matters is, in, you know, when you're playing in Jacksonville against Georgia, when the stands are hopefully full again, you know, are you able to put five sacks on JT Daniels and let us put more memes of him in turtlenecks out there after the game?
Oh, man. That was awful. Like, really? Turtlenecks in Georgia for one. I don't know, man. That was awful.
Hey,
I'm no fashion guy. Don't get me wrong, but man, I'm just he brought the California fashion with him to Athens. I don't think it fits too well.
I'm just glad he got rid of the mustache, man, because the mustache is a little bit disturbing. But you know, hey, he's the perfect foil for us, right? I mean, he's the Georgia quarterback, kind of looks like a villain in a superhero movie that you're just sort of rooting against. So
I sent that picture to my Georgia friends. I was like, there's no way you guys are winning the national championship with this.
Well, all I know is that there will be some good memes if Florida's defensive line is able to put Daniels on his back four or five times next year in Jacksonville. And I'm here for it, man. I'm here for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, last one here. Hey, special teams. We'll go forget. A couple people asked about special teams here. And so I think we'll go that route to end it here. Bradley Wentworth, he goes, what's the special teams outlook? Who's returning kicks? And what does our kick punter situation look like? Not as glamorous, but very important. Not a whole lot of info out there on special teams. It's just kind of how the nature of the beast for spring practice is, just especially when we're not allowed out there, so we don't control where the camera gets to go and all that stuff. And I've been asking around, a little bit. Still not a lot of info out there as far as what they're doing on special teams at the moment. As far as returners go, I do wonder if running back depth and the focus on offense plays into it a bit. Like, if you don't think you could put up as many points as last season, then do you try and steal points on special teams? Look, you don't worry about injury concerns here of a player returning kicks or punts. I think that comes into it a little bit. But if you got playmakers, DeMarcus Bowman, Lorenzo Lingard out there who have shown flashes of speeds, do you get them on special teams just to try and steal some points on there? Look, you don't steal many points on kick returns right now. You don't get the return all that many. But punt returns, I think, is where you try to look for a place if you want to try and steal some points. So do you put a player back there that you expect to be a big contributor on offense or defense to return kicks? And look, I don't believe in coaching scare because of injuries. Injuries are part of the game. It happens. But we'll always go back to 2005 and Andre Caldwell getting injured in Meyer's first year, his first season there, injured on a kickoff return versus Tennessee early in the season. He was the electric playmaker in those first few games for that Florida offense, and then went on to struggle for most of the season in Urban Meyer's first year, but went down on a kickoff return in Meyer's first year for the rest of the season. So now this Gator team has some options, and it's hard to get info about who's out there returning kicks, but Bowman, Lingard, Henderson, Weston is, you know, Mullen mentioned him as being the fastest player at wide receiver, so maybe you put him back there. But also Finley Graham, I think that's the guy you really have to watch out for. I'm intrigued with that's what he was known for as his role in high school, electric return man in high school. Think about this, you know, especially punt returns. Yeah, Mullen's got to put somebody back there he trusts, Will. Yes, he had Tony back there last season, but before that, it was Freddie Swain. And someone Mullen knew would go out there and make the right decision most of the time. Player that would catch it, not muff the ball, know when to call for a fair catch, a player that wouldn't dance around for a big loss. I think all that trust we saw at Tony at wide receiver last year also translated to him as a punt returner. Mullen trusting as a player finally and put him all over the field. You catch the ball, get upfield. You know, don't be taking huge losses and put your offense in bad positions there. As far as kicker goes, Jace Chrisman transferred from Mississippi State, where he was a starting place kicker from 2017, 2019, lost a starting job last season, but 32 of 40 on field goals in his career at Mississippi State with a long of 51. taking over for, you know, somewhat disappointing Evan McPherson last season after he missed five field goals, including that game ender versus LSU to try and force overtime there. Putter will be Australian Jeremy Crawshaw, had two punts versus Oklahoma for 98 yards. So there's your special teams catch up. But yeah, well, I think it's very intriguing what you do at return just because of some of the playmakers you do have at the running back position.
Well, Instagram tells me that Zach Carter is going to be returning punts. That's what I saw the other day. Apparently, he was the only defensive lineman who actually caught one, I think was the what was the take home from there.
So we're putting him on the 10-yard line and telling him not to back up, but make sure you catch it.
Hey, I wouldn't want to run into him. I would give him a 3-yard halo if I was a defensive back gunner running down there. But now, you know, you make some really good points. I think they've got a pretty decent stable of cornerbacks as well. They've over-recruited the cornerback position over the last couple of years. So guys like Ethan Pouncey, guys like Jason Marshall, those sorts of guys might get an opportunity to show their wares on special teams, especially early in the year. That is something that they had Kyrie Elam do a lot of special teams his freshman year before they finally put him on the field, you know, maybe halfway through and let him really start to shine at corner. So I would expect those would be the two areas where you'd probably see those guys in. But, you know, the thing I remember about those Urban Meyer teams, and, you know, I went to Virginia Tech. My dad grew up in Blacksburg. So, you know, sort of grew up watching Beamer ball, watched them win games they shouldn't win because they were turning the game on a special team score. And it's not a momentum thing. It's a, when you earn yourself 7 points because you're able to block a kick and you put yourself either in fantastic field position or you're able to return it for a touchdown, you know, that just, it puts the opposition behind the eight ball immediately. Usually you're going to be, if you're a team like Florida, you're going to be, you know, within 7 points of all of your opposition. So if you can get an extra 7, it really puts you in the driver's seat. We saw that against Auburn a couple of years ago where there were just turnovers back and forth, back and forth, back and forth the whole game. But, you know, there was a punt that Auburn muffed. And then there was, you know, the guy who picked up the fumble from Trask and then fumbled it on, or no, he looked like he got shot by a sniper, went down, and then Auburn turned the ball over right after that. You know, the reality is that those sorts of plays are the things that turn games when they're close. And Florida just hasn't had any of those, right? There wasn't really, you know, the whole game was screaming for a special teams play against Texas A&M, just not able to get it done. You think if they block a punt against LSU or block a field goal against LSU, all of a sudden it changes the complexion of that game because Florida is able to get up by a score or two and really put some pressure on Max Johnson. And then, you know, you maybe get a pick because he's got to start to force the ball into different holes. So those are the things I'm looking for. You know, the days of Jeff Dempsey and Chris Rainey coming off the corner and blocking a kick, I mean, those days have to come back. And hopefully they've built up some more depth with some of these recruiting classes where they're going to be able to do that, because that has not occurred in Mullen's first 3 years. I mean, you mentioned Tony back there, you know, not really a burner. Like he can change directions extraordinarily fast, which makes him a real weapon when it comes to having a corner, you know, that he gets in one-on-one coverage. But I never thought of him as a guy who was a threat to take the ball to the house. I mean, he took the one back against Kentucky, but that's because Kentucky's entire punt defense ran in the wrong direction because of the deke from Xavier Henderson. Yeah, so I don't never really think of him as – I thought of him as more of a conservative choice back there. Freddie Swain was definitely a conservative choice back there to catch punts, never really a threat. So, you know, that's the thing I'm interested in. You mentioned Weston. Maybe Henderson is back there catching punts. You know, maybe one of these young guys steps up. Collier maybe is somebody who steps up. You know, a guy who's got quite a bit of speed, used to be a corner, got a little bit bigger, isn't necessarily probably going to see the field as a safety a lot as a true freshman, but he'll be able to see the field if they get him out there on special teams. So those are the things that I'm sort of looking for. That and having the fast guys, sort of the backup DBs at gunner, right? When's the last time you remember a guy coming down and absolutely demolishing the opposing punt returner? We haven't had that either. So, you know, I think part of it is that Mullen's been trying to paper over holes on the offensive and particularly last year, the defensive side of the ball, and hasn't really had a whole lot of time to focus on special teams. So you put guys back there that you trust and guys back there that you know are going to be consistent, even if they're not necessarily game changers. But especially considering some of the limitations this team's going to have in 2021, I think that it's a good opportunity to get young guys on the field. You're probably going to have more than your 85 scholarship limit because of the way COVID works and because of guys getting extra years and stuff like that. So you don't necessarily – all the guys who were on the roster last year get an extra year, right? So you have the, you essentially got a free redshirt year last year where they've all got 4 years of eligibility left. So there's no reason to have a guy, to not have a guy on special teams if he's gifted, and to not get guys that sort of experience. So hopefully we'll see that. But like you said, we haven't gotten any information about it. It's not something you're going to get from the Instagram posts. But I hope that part of the benefit of having practice closed is that they have the ability to really work on some things that are going to make a difference on the special teams this year.
All right. All right. That'll do it. Q&A episode here of Gators Breakdown. Everybody, thanks for sending the questions. I'm about to do a YouTube version as well. Everybody in the chat on the YouTube version. Everybody here who's almost here every week, thanks so much. We'll have to repay you and do a Q&A just for the YouTube chat as well. Done it one time before. Definitely have to do it again. Will Gators scrimmage March 6th. A scrimmage coming up. First scrimmage of the spring for the Gators. So we'll see if anything leaks out there, or maybe the Gators will be doing some stuff that they'll be posting on social media. So we'll see what they're going to do for the scrimmages coming up. Three scrimmages this spring. That'll be March 6th will be the first one. I think the other one is the 12th and the 20th, I believe, there. So three of them, maybe the one on the 20th. You know, Scott Strickland did say when they announced spring would be closed and they wouldn't have a traditional spring game, they would still do something on TV for the SEC network. And I believe he pinpointed that March 20th date. There is a scrimmage that day. So hopefully we get something a little more that day.
Yeah, man, I'm just praying for ACLs, praying for healthy ACLs, and hopefully everybody gets through the spring. It's interesting. They've sort of built themselves some extra time in case there were any sort of COVID issues, but also, you know, in case there's any injuries. So hopefully they are able to hit significantly this year and work on hitting and tackling. And you know, Florida's going to come out next year as one of the best tackling teams in the country, because they do have a level of talent where if they tackle consistently, they should be able to compete with anybody. But obviously,
all about the tease for me on defense, Will. Technique, tackle, and turnovers. Let's go.
Yeah, where's lining up?
Put that under tempo. Put that under tempo. I'll add one more tee.
Well, we're not here to talk about 2020, Dave. So,
hey, 2021's got a lot to do with 2020. So. Oh, Ty Grantham, darn you. He doesn't want to talk about it, Will. But here's the thing. I don't know. I mean, that's a coach thing. Even if the defense was really good, well, that was last year. We got to do what we got to do for 2021. So I don't know. But
yeah, Grantham has a Belichick personality, but he doesn't necessarily have the track record. He's not shutting down the Buffalo Bills and Jim Kelly and the K-Gun. Yeah. At least he hasn't done it yet. If he shuts down Alabama and he shuts down Georgia next year, I'll shut up. It's fine. I will give him the credit that he deserves for turning things around. And, you know, hey, it's great he didn't focus on 2020, but I think there's some things you can learn from 2020.
Yeah.
And hopefully the team learns from it, because tempo's not going away.
Nope. Especially when teams know you had problems with it. So early on in the season, I expect to see that those teams Florida's play and to test Florida and see if they've improved that the tempo part of the defense. All right, Will, anything else coming up? I know you had the Gilbert article up on Read and Reaction. Anything else coming up this week?
Yeah, so I have been working on an Emory Jones article, sort of talking about the things he does well and the things he doesn't do well. That was going to run this week, but now it was going to run this past week, but it didn't because of the Gilbert stuff. So that'll probably go up this week. Now, beyond that, just sort of taking it easy. The baby is taking up just as much time as you would imagine. So, you know, it's hard to – I can't type with one hand, so.
Plenty of congrats sent your way last week when we announced it on the podcast. So that was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate it. Mom's doing fine. We're sleeping decently, but it's an adjustment. And he's our fourth, so – the other three have had to adjust as well. So it's been an interesting time. I'm just glad he didn't come in September, because I would have had to ignore him. Shut up.
Yeah, honey,
Emory's playing. Emory's playing.
Yeah, honey, go to the hospital. I'll be there in a little while. All right, that's Will Miles. You can find him on Twitter at WillMilesSEC and his site, readandreaction.com. I'm the host of Gators Breakdown, David Waters. You can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Guys and girls out there, thanks for listening to this episode of Gators Breakdown.